This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, boys and girls. Thank you for being with us today. This is WNRN and the Sunday morning wake-up call. Today, one of those topics that gets everybody all aflutter. No matter which side of the coin you're on, no matter whether or not you know all the history and upkeep of information that you should know, we're going to be talking about the minimum wage. Even those of you at Harrisonburg's 95.1, as well as those of you on 91.9. So our guest today, a professor, let's go right to the source for our information, Professor William Johnson of UVA's Department of Economics. One of the courses he teaches for the undergrads, Economics of Labor. Good morning, Professor Johnson.
Good morning, Rick.
Thank you so much for taking what has turned into be a beautiful Sunday and some time to come in here and sit inside with us.
My pleasure.
Although we did open the windows. Oh, don't tell anyone. Apparently they're not supposed to be open so we can enjoy the beautiful day. So Professor William Johnson here to talk about minimum wage with us. Professor, jump right into it. A bit of history on the minimum wage. Sometime in the early 20th century, somebody said, oh my goodness, somebody's taking advantage of somebody else, right? Is that how it all starts?
The minimum wage was part of an important piece of labor legislation in the New Deal called the Fair Labor Standards Act, which did other things. It started the legal requirement for time and a half for overtime, et cetera. But the minimum wage was a big part of the Fair Labor Standards Act. There were a lot of motivations for the minimum wage enactment. And by the way, one reason it got enacted in the New Deal is that for the first time, the Supreme Court would allow it as constitutional. Before that, legislation like the minimum wage would be viewed as an unconstitutional interference in the right of a worker and an employer to make an agreement about working conditions and pay. But in the New Deal, the Supreme Court changed its mind and finally allowed legislation like this. So one of the motivations, obviously, was to give people a raise, but there were macroeconomic motivations. It was felt during the New Deal that one of the reasons we were in a depression was that the people didn't have enough, the term back then was purchasing power. They couldn't go out and purchase the goods, and the minimum wage was viewed as a way of giving people purchasing power and getting us out of the depression. There were also some, interestingly, you might say, politically selfish motivations for the minimum wage. At that time in New England, the textile industry, which had started in New England, was very important in New England, was being lured to the low-wage South, being lured to North Carolina, to Virginia, to South Carolina, to Georgia, because wages were lower in those southern states. Now, of course, we think of the textile industry as southern moving to China, but at that time it was New England moving to the South for low wages. The New England political representatives supported a minimum wage as a way of reducing the competition from the South. New England wages were above the minimum wage enacted in the 1930s. Southern wages generally were lower. And so by raising your competitor's wage, you reduce the incentive for textile mills to move from New England to the South. That was one of the political motivations. I don't think it's the most important one, but sort of a patchwork of rationales for the national minimum wage.
Again, our guest today, Professor William Johnson from UVA's Department of Economics, as we talk about the minimum wage. So, Professor Johnson, as I'm sort of doing my homework, now I took economics 101 and 102 when I was at UVA and quickly learned that that wasn't my thing. But as I'm doing my homework to prepare for this as more of an adult than at the time, I realized, you know what, economics is really just math meets politics. Because many people say when you're talking about the minimum wage, you need to take the politics out of it. Because that's why the Democrats want to do this or the Republicans want to do this. But if you take the politics out of it and really identify what happens mathematically to those who are employed, low wage or unemployed, or what happens to the business owners, stick to the math. But that's right. Not possible, is it?
Well, I think economists would like to think it's possible. I mean, there are empirical methodologies that economists use to try to ask questions like, you know, what is the effect of the minimum wage on the employment of teenagers? Or what is the effect of the minimum wage on poverty? Presumably, the answers to questions like that are important in informing one's political beliefs. Now, I think economics has enough scientific stature that it's not just a matter of, if I'm a liberal Democrat, I'm going to cook the numbers to present to conclude the minimum wage has positive effects, and if I'm a conservative Republican, I'm going to cook the numbers in another way to find that it's got negative effects. There is a broad, middle, nonpartisan body of scientific evidence. Now, of course, because the minimum wage is such a political issue, it does get tinged with politics here and there. But I think there is a body of research evidence that's not tinged by politics that we can look at. Now, unfortunately, there's always going to be controversy about which research studies use the right methodology. There are going to be arguments about very mundane points about the data and the interpretation of various statistical results. But we can try to put our scientific hats on and take off our political hats and look at the evidence.
Well, let's see if we can actually do that, because I'm sure I'll drive back to the political part throughout the hour. 11:09 here Sunday morning on WNRN. Our guest today, Professor William Johnson from UVA's Department of Economics. You know, Professor, I'm again doing my homework in preparation for the show. It's not very difficult. I think most people know or aren't surprised by the fact that the federal minimum wage today, $7.25 an hour. But, you bring up the map of the United States that shows who's following the minimum wage, who's higher than the current minimum wage. And I'm surprised to see that there are three states, Georgia, Wyoming, and Arkansas, whose states have less than the federal minimum wage. How do you do that?
I guess you're talking about a state minimum wage.
Right.
Yeah. What's probably happened is, they've probably enacted a state minimum wage in the past and just haven't kept up with the federal. The federal will supersede a state minimum wage. But there are a number of states on the other side of the ledger who have enacted state-wide minimum wage laws that are higher than the federal minimum. So the federal minimum doesn't really bite in those states. It's the state minimum And I think there are 20 or 30 of
Well, the map that I used, and I'm not going to tell you that I was that it was updated till through September of 2014, showed 23 states
23.
That were higher,
right.
had a higher minimum wage right. than the federal
right.
level.
So, which, you know, in the states, Virginia is a state that doesn't have a state minimum. So the federal minimum applies in Virginia, but a state can over, you know, can enact a higher minimum than the federal minimum, and then that's what's in effect. So states like Hawaii and I think the District of Columbia has a higher minimum. Maryland probably has a higher.
California, Oregon, Washington.
Right. They tend to be the more liberal Democratic states, Northeast Pacific Coast.
Now, there were 10 states that whose minimum wage numbers are linked to the Consumer Price Index.
Right.
So that seems like something that an economics professor can talk about for a moment.
Yes.
So the Consumer Price Index, define that for me.
Well, that is an index of prices that the government puts together to try to track, the, sort of generally speaking, the cost of living for typical American. Now, there are lots of variations on the Consumer Price Index, but it's a very popular price index to index. If what you wanted to do was to keep the ability to buy goods and services, that is how much your money is going to buy. If you wanted to keep that constant, you'd want to inflate it or you'd want to adjust it by the Consumer Price Index. There are some economists who have some technical complaints about how that index is constructed and think it might overstate inflation. But if we accept the index as a good measure of prices, the intention is to say, let's establish when you index the minimum wage to the Consumer Price Index, the intention is to say, let's establish a basket of goods that we think that real goods and services that we think workers should be able to buy with their hour of work, and then let's adjust the minimum wage as prices change so that over time workers can still buy that same basket of goods and services.
So let's, before we came on the air, even when I went to the back to the point of inviting you to be the guest to talk about this, I never asked your political viewpoint. But as we've already identified, politics play a role in this topic. So let's see if we can guess your political views on a couple questions
okay.
here. True or false, raising the minimum wage will stimulate the economy?
I think generally false.
Because you can't say push. It's got to be true or false. There's no tie. All right. True or false, raising the minimum wage will increase unemployment?
That I'll be agnostic about. I do think that raising the minimum wage will reduce employment, and you might be thinking right now, well, isn't reducing employment the same thing as increasing unemployment? But it turns out not necessarily, because people can drop in and out of the labor force. And so when you look at the technical studies, of which there have been many, this is a well-studied topic within economics, it's harder to find consistent results on unemployment than it is to find consistent results on employment. So I think there is evidence that particular vulnerable groups, and by vulnerable I mean likely to be the most affected by the minimum wage, that would be teenagers and other low-skilled workers. There is fairly convincing evidence, and again, there are going to be economists who would disagree with this, that probably has a slightly negative effect on employment.
Okay, and we'll come back to these throughout the hour and a little more time on each. Raising the minimum wage will reduce poverty.
Well, that's one I think counter to a lot of people's intuition. I think the answer there is probably no, it won't. And it has to do with some features of low-wage workers that may surprise many listeners. So if I can just spend a little time on this, it's sort of a counterintuitive result. You would think that it would have to reduce poverty. The reason it doesn't, or it doesn't have as strong an effect in any case, is I think almost all economists, whatever stripe, would probably agree that it doesn't have a strong effect on poverty or on the distribution of income, strongly egalitarian effect on that. The reason is there are a lot of low-wage workers who aren't in particularly low-income households. And so if you look at the one statistic that sticks in my mind is that of all the workers who are directly affected by the minimum wage, that is workers at or just above the minimum wage, only 9% of them are heads of poverty households. So you might have the view that there's sort of a one-to-one matching between low-wage workers and low-income households, and that's a lot weaker relationship than you might think. There are low-income households that don't have low-wage workers, so would not be positively affected by minimum wages. In fact, if minimum wages raise prices of goods that those households have to buy, they can be negatively affected. There are also a lot of low-wage workers that aren't in particularly low-income households. These would be second and third workers in multi-earner households where the added wage income that might be generated by a minimum wage doesn't add to the income of a poverty household. It adds to the income of a higher income household. So the connection between poverty and minimum wages and, you know, the distribution of income generally and minimum wages is a lot looser than I think most people think.
Our guest today, Professor William Johnson from UVA's Department of Economics. It is 11:18 here on the Wake Up Call. You're welcome to call in, ask your question, make your comment. Mallory will pick up the phone. It's 434-979-0919. Be right back.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Brown Automotive Group, locally owned and community focused for over 30 years and featuring previously enjoyed fuel efficient models, luxury models, and budget models backed with a Carfax report and 7-day exchange policy. You can browse the selection online at brownautos.com.
Music Today. Based in Crozet, Music Today powers ticketing for local venues such as the Intellos Wireless Pavilion, the Southern Cafe and Music Hall, and the Jefferson Theater, and is official web stores for hundreds of artists, athletes, and entertainers. That's Music Today.
Far Downers, local beer, local food, local music, and local vibe at the Square in Crozet. Far Downers serves local and organic meats, breads, and beers, has nightly dinner specials, Sunday brunch, live music every weekend, and can cater your next event. Find the menu and music schedule at fardowners.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks for being with us today on a beautiful Sunday here at WNRN. Talking about minimum wage, the federal minimum wage currently $7.25 an hour. What are the economic effects behind raising it or leaving it as it is? Our guest, Professor William Johnson, UVA Department of Economics, one of his courses being the economics of labor. So we were just doing some true and false questions. I have my personal idea on who you voted for the last couple times around, but I won't ask you to give out your share that with everybody who's listening today. So let's see. We're adjusting the minimum wage for inflation. Have non-minimum wages people, has that increased? Because we always talk about, oh, we have to be aware we've only increased the minimum wage this much since then. I don't even remember when I was, I think my first paying, full paying job from an employer was when I was 14. And I don't remember what my minimum wage was at the time, but it wasn't $7.25, but it wasn't some ridiculous, you know, it wasn't 15 cents either. And so during this time frame, certainly the cost of gas and food and the consumer price index that we were talking about has increased a lot more than the minimum wage. So people always talk about keeping the minimum wage up with inflation. But even if we did that, and the fact that we haven't done that, how about non-minimum wages? Have they increased to a greater or lesser extent than minimum wage payment?
The big erosion in the real minimum wage, and the real by the real minimum wage, I mean the minimum wage adjusted for inflation, that eroded fairly dramatically during the 1980s. Since then, I think the erosion has been slighter, although I don't have those numbers right at my command. The minimum wage, so that's one question, that is what's happened to the real minimum wage. I think your other question was what's happened to the minimum wage relative to other wages.
Or actually reverse that. What has happened to real wages versus those? I think many people would say that those who are earning minimum wage, that's part of the regular conversation for those who are promoting an increase, is that it has not in any way kept close with inflation. And that's why it needs to go up. Back in the 1970s, the minimum wage was $3.25. And so minimum wage has slightly more than doubled. Has the average, family leader number one income, has that kept up with inflation, been so poorly kept up with inflation like minimum wage earners?
Well, there's actually a debate about that, and part of the debate has to do with our measurement of changes in prices over time, which is, maybe it's always been difficult, but it's been particularly difficult in this era where we're all walking around with these little machines in our pockets that didn't exist 30 years ago. So how do we account for, namely cell phones, how do we account for new goods when constructing a price index? What you want to do when you construct a price index, ideally, is to say, let's go back to 1970 and price a basket of goods. And now let's compare that the price of that basket of goods with the price of the same goods in 2014. Well, we don't have the same goods in 2014. We have a bunch of stuff like flat-screen televisions and cell phones and a lot of medical procedures that are different, that didn't exist in 1970. So how can we price the same basket of goods? We're now buying different goods that weren't even available in 1970. That's a very difficult problem. There are technical ways to try to tackle that. There are economists that I respect who think that the way the government statisticians have tackled it has probably led to slight overstatements in the rate of inflation, that is, the comparison of the cost of the 1970 basket with the 2014 basket. What that's going to mean is that when we use, I'm sorry, this is getting so technical, but if we think that the price of the same basket of goods has gone up more than it really has, then the flip side of that is we're going to think that wages have lagged behind prices more than they may have. So the statistics using the Consumer Price Index about the purchasing power or the real wages and their trend over time may be more negative than they really are. So that is a debate that gets into the statistical weeds, if you want, of quite technical arguments about exactly what wages should we look at and how should we adjust for price
changes. So if the Consumer Price Index is not relevant, because it can't be done.
Well, it's the best we've got. I mean, I'm not saying you definitely want to look at it. It's just that there are some legitimate arguments that for one reason or another, it has overstated the inflation of prices. Another example is it was very late to recognize that a lot of people are buying goods in places like Walmart and Costco where the price is lower than it is in regular stores. And because it was late to recognize that shift, that's another upward bias in the Consumer Price Index.
But what about, again, we stick with the Consumer Price Index for another question or two. Again, we're talking about the minimum wage and whether or not to increase the minimum wage and its effect on society and economics. Here with our Professor William Johnson from the University of Virginia Department of Economics. So give me a couple items that are part of the Consumer Price Index. You keep talking about the basket. What's in the basket?
Well, there are thousands of items,
Just pick a couple. I mean, are we talking about a pound of grapes?
Well, it's supposed to reflect.
Would a gallon of fuel be in the basket?
Oh, sure. It's supposed to reflect the consumption of, an American household. So it's going to include everything that an American household buys. The problem occurs that if you looked at what an American household bought in 1970, that's a different basket than what they buy in 2014. We weren't buying internet access. We weren't buying cell phones. We weren't buying computers. We weren't buying a number of current expensive drugs that have been developed since 1970. So that presents the technical issue of how do we compare the prices of these two baskets, the 1970 basket and the 2014 basket, when the items in the basket are different. And moreover, some of the items in the 2014 basket didn't even exist in 1970. That's a huge issue, and it's a challenge to construct a price index. One, listeners might want to think if they've been around as long as I have and so have seen, prices change and their incomes change, would they rather have their wages in 2014 with the prices and the goods that are available in 2014, or would they rather have their wages of 1970 with the prices and the goods that were available in 1970? If the answer is you prefer the 2014 wages and prices and goods, then an economist would say your real income is higher in 2014 than it was in 1970. You think you're better off with the wages you get in 2014, paying the prices you pay in 2014 for the goods and services that are available in 2014 as compared with the same elements in 1970. If you say I'd prefer 2014, then you've essentially said I'm better off in 2014 and my real income is higher in 2014.
Yeah, but doesn't that really just identify your age?
Yes.
That's like, no, it was much better back then.
Well, if you think it was better back then, take a look at the Sears catalog in 1970 and look at that, some of that stuff. And,
Did they even have a Sears catalog? Go to the Montgomery Ward catalog. Yeah. What?
Oh, they had it. Or, take a look at a car built in 1970 compared to a car that you might buy in 2014. There's a tremendous difference in terms of technical advance, safety, fuel economy, to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is the government bureau that constructs the Consumer Price Index, to their credit, they try to take account of these quality differences, that they try to account for the fact that a car in 2014 is a much better car than the typical car in 1970.
Again, our guest today, Professor William Johnson from UVA's Department of Economics, as we talk about minimum wage. You're welcome to call in if you have a question or a comment, 434-979-0919. Professor, the current debate about whether or not to raise the minimum wage has been played out in a very upfront method by fast food workers going on strike demanding to be paid $15 an hour.
Yes.
And I think for what has been the very simple reaction to that has been, if you're pro, then you say yes, they don't make enough money to support their families, or con, if you do that, you won't be able to afford the burger that they currently supply you with.
Well, both could be true. I mean, it is hard to support a family on a minimum wage job. I did mention before that not all that many minimum wage workers are the heads of low-income households, and so some of them, many of them, are secondary, tertiary workers in multi-earner households whose income is above the poverty line. It's also true that, especially industries like the restaurant industry, the profit margins are pretty slim. It's not going to be possible to pay substantially higher wages to workers entirely out of the profits of those firms. And so in the new, economists talk about equilibrium, if we shock the fast food industry with a big increase in the wages they pay in the new equilibrium, I'm sure prices of fast food would be higher. People would buy less fast food. There'd be less demand for fast food. Some restaurants would close. Employment would be down in that industry by that, just because people want less fast food when it's more expensive.
All right, so here's a question from James. By the way, James left this, so you're welcome to call in on the phone line, 979-0919. But James from Charlottesville, how has the end of labor unions and collective bargaining affected the minimum wage?
Good. That's a good question. I mean, that would be a more political question, I think.
Because, James may be in your class.
Yeah, maybe. The labor unions have always been a strong supporter of higher minimum wages. And again, you could have two spins on that. And I'm sure there's an element of truth to both spin. One spin is that labor unions are, most members of labor unions earn far more than the minimum wage. So why are they interested in raising the minimum wage? One argument would be a very charitable argument that labor unions are concerned about all workers and want to pull up workers who are not their members. Another spin would be a little more cynical, which is that cheap labor makes labor unions less powerful. Cheap non-unionized labor makes labor unions less powerful. Just as the New England representatives in the Depression wanted to reduce the competition from the low-wage South, the labor union would want to reduce the competition from lower-wage, minimum-wage workers. But whichever story you believe, and there's probably an element of truth to both of them, the politics of minimum wages is that labor unions have always been strong supporters of minimum wages. That's going to mean that as labor unions get weaker, as they definitely have in the United States, they're organizing at less than 10% of private sector workers these days. Their political power has waned somewhat, and that's going to play into the politics of the minimum wage debate.
11:37 here on the Wake Up Call. Back in just a moment.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Massanutten Resort, welcoming you for a round at their two 18-hole golf courses, plus group and private lessons from PGA professionals and driving range. Massanutten is the place for a day trip or weekend getaway. Details for Massanutten's golf, indoor water park, spa, and full resort amenities are at massresort.com. Route 11 Potato Chips, celebrating 20 years of making all-natural, kettle-cooked potato chips in Mount Jackson, Virginia. Route 11 Potato Chips offers flavors like Chesapeake Crab and Dill Pickle, all cooked in sunflower oil in an environmentally friendly facility. Information for retail outlets and fry viewings is at rt11.com.
Automated Office Systems, providing WNRN with personalized local copier and printer service and maintenance. Automated Office Systems is headquarters for all of your computer needs, including sales and service of desktops, laptops, and tablets. That's Automated Office Systems, AOScorp.net.
Hello, I'm Maid Carrion from the Charlottesville Derby Dames. On September 27th, the Charlottesville Derby Dames present The Lord of the Rinks, a roller derby bout between Charlottesville's own Belmont Bruisers and Killdevil Derby Brigade from Killdevil Hills, North Carolina. This bout will take place at Augusta Expo Land in Fishersville. Doors open at 6 p.m., bout starts at 7 p.m. As always, this is a family-friendly event. You can get your tickets in advance at Blue Moon Diner, Brown Paper Tickets, or from a Charlottesville Derby Dame. A portion of the proceeds will benefit the Woodrow Wilson Rehabilitation Center's LEAP program. For more, CharlottesvilleDerbyDames.com. I'm Maid Carrion, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today, talking about the minimum wage with Professor... Oh, Scott didn't hang on. Scott, call us back. We had a caller on the line who didn't want to wait for me to go through all of the underwriting. So 434-979-0919. Talking with Professor William Johnson from UVA's Department of Economics about the minimum wage. So, Professor, is this, you know, we talk about this and the minimum wage. Is this a conversation about the individual versus the group? Because it always seems like you're, you know, personally, I would like my income increased. And possibly as a group, And if we did that for everybody, that may not help the nation.
Well, I think there is an element of that. I think the minimum wage is an appealing policy because its benefits seem so obvious, and its costs are hidden somewhat. And one way to think about it is if we think of the total income of the country is, to a rough approximation, our production of goods and services, under most circumstances, and I'll mention the exception because that's the one case where there might be a good argument for a minimum wage, or there's a stronger argument for a minimum wage, but under most circumstances, by which I mean in the long run, there are competitive labor and product markets. There is no way that a minimum wage can increase if you want the size of the pie. So what we're doing is shrinking. Think of the pot, the amount of goods and services as a pizza that has to be sliced up among 310 or 15 million people. When we impose a minimum wage, we can't increase the size of the pizza. If anything, it's going to decrease. And then we're slicing it in different ways. So some people might get bigger slices as measured by the weight of that slice, but that's got to mean other people have smaller slices. So we're redistributing, we're shrinking the pie and changing how it's distributed across everyone in the population. So if there are winners on an individual level, they're also going to be losers. And of course, the question is, who are those losers? And that's the subject of some economic research. Again, not all economists agree about this because there are different ways of tackling the question and different data sets, etc. But to some extent, the losers might not, it isn't a question of it's the 1%, the top 1% losing and the bottom gaining. It's more a question, it's more ambiguous than that. There are some people at the bottom who are going to gain. There may be other people at the bottom who are going to lose. But there can't be a net gain because the size of the pizza can't increase in the normal case. Now, let me just mention, for fear that you can stop me if I go on too long, but I just want to make sure that everybody understands there is a type of labor market pathology called monopsony, under which a minimum wage can actually increase the size of the pie, the pizza that gets shared. And monopsony occurs when employers have excessive power in the labor market, where workers don't have choices among potential employers. And that may occur in the short run, but to my way of thinking, it's hard to see how I'm sure there are isolated instances, but in our modern economy, with the density of population we have, the mobility of workers have choices, and if they're presented with lousy choices at one employer, they can move to other employers. And if employers don't have that power of sort of a captive labor force that doesn't have alternatives, then we're in a world of competition, and there the pie has to shrink. Now, it still may be worth it, even though the pie shrinks, to redistribute the slices, but we have to recognize that the pie is shrinking.
Let me see if Scott is still there. Scott, are you with us?
I am.
All right. Your question for Professor Johnson. Thanks for hanging on.
Sure, and I would obviously hasten to add, I'm no economist, but going back to something that was said earlier, I guess one thought is that there is the issue of if you raise wages, the minimum wage, there was, I'm not I guess the statement was, if you raise wages, then automatically prices would rise. And to a certain extent, I would, as a naive person, assume that those are totally unrelated, that the amount you pay an employee is totally governed by what the market availability of jobs, training, and so forth would bear. And then the amount you can charge a sandwich is unrelated to, it may be bound at some point, but it's totally unrelated to what it costs you to make it. You're, once again, bound by what people will pay for the sandwich. Obviously, it's complicated because there's an interaction, but it's quite possible Hardee's, for example, could double their wages and still make a profit, in which case they could still charge the same amount for the sandwich. So it seems like the cost of the labor and the amount people are willing to pay for the sandwich at some point have limits, but are totally unrelated in some sense to the sort of, that may be simplistic, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. And I'll hang up so I can listen, okay?
Thanks, Scott.
Mm-hmm. I guess, Scott, I think they are related, maybe not in a one-to-one relationship, but it has to be the case. First of all, profits in many industries aren't enough to absorb all of the wage increase. And even if they were, in the long run, people who invest their capital in different industries are going to move away. They're going to move capital out of industries where they can't make a good rate of profit and move it into industries where they can. But if wages rise for all fast food restaurants, let's think of a world where they're competing against each other, I think it's inevitable that prices are going to rise for those fast food restaurants. Now, often the owners of the restaurants have sort of a myopic view about the effects of minimum wages, and they will argue, you know, that they sort of see the current prices they can charge as constant and their costs going up, and that's going to squeeze their profits. And that's a bit myopic, because if all fast food restaurants or if all restaurants have to pay a higher minimum wage, then everybody's costs are going to go up, everybody's prices are going to go up, and you're not competing, an individual restaurant is not competing against a restaurant that's charging the low prices that they could charge with a lower minimum wage, but the higher prices they have to charge with a higher minimum wage. So some of the doom and gloom on the basis of individual, you know, that you hear from individual business owners is probably overdone, because they're not accounting for the fact that their competition is going to have higher prices as well. They're going to not be competing against lower cost competitors. They're going to be competing against higher cost competitors. But still, costs have to be covered, and labor costs are part of the cost. So prices will go up, and when prices go up, people buy, you know, the one law of economics that nobody has repealed yet is the law of demand, that says that people buy less stuff when it's more expensive. And you can see that when you're traveling. I just took a trip to Australia and New Zealand, which have very high minimum wages equivalent of U.S. dollars of $15. And you can see it, I think, in the restaurant prices. They're substantially higher than U.S. restaurant prices. But interestingly, there's no tradition of tipping, especially in New Zealand. So, and people don't feel guilty not tipping, because they say, well, these restaurant workers are well paid. They're getting a high wage. I don't need to add anything onto it. But my guess is, and I haven't looked at this, but my guess is, just from my casual impression, that eating out is rarer in New Zealand than it is in the U.S. That's just a reflection of the downward sloping demand curve. The fact that restaurant meals are more expensive in New Zealand means fewer of them are eaten. And that's one of the things that's going to affect employment when the minimum wage goes up.
11:50 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Professor William Johnson from University of Virginia's Department of Economics, talking about the minimum wage. You're welcome to call in with your question or comment. We have about 10 minutes left, 434-979-0919. So, Professor, and to Scott, let me throw my background into this as someone who's spent almost their entire career in the food service industry. So when I started, I was taught early on that if you want to make a, if the customer is going to spend $1, 33 cents of that goes towards your labor. That's not just your hourly employees. That's everyone who's taking home money, management, owner, etc. 33 cents of that goes towards your overhead, rent, building, electricity, etc. And 33 cents goes toward your product. You have to buy the hamburger meat to sell as a hamburger. And that leaves one penny profit. So if you want to make more pennies out of that dollar, you have to trim your costs somewhere. You find a way to watch your electric bill better. You make better deals in purchasing your hamburger meat. You watch your labor. So there's a couple things that I see here, which are that if you're going to increase your minimum wage, then you have to trim your wage somewhere else. So that's part of the commentary that you get, is that the owners, those people who take home the multi-million dollar paychecks, need to contribute to the cost a little bit. And that would save you money, or at least keep that as a balance on the 33% of labor costs. And then you talk about going to New Zealand, where the costs of going out are more expensive, so you don't tip. Well, heck, maybe you don't eat as much. Maybe you don't have an appetizer and a meal and a dessert, and you don't have the weight problems that I contribute to in this country.
Well, Rick, I think actually I think a higher minimum wage would have certainly one beneficial effect, and it would reduce obesity, because Americans eat out a lot because it's darn cheap, and it's darn cheap because labor in restaurants isn't paid very much. So, we could go to if you've ever been in Sweden, you know that eating out in Sweden is astronomically expensive, or Norway. We could go to a Swedish or Norwegian restaurant economy, and people wouldn't be eating out as much as they do now. So maybe there would be some benefit there. Your point about the owners of restaurants taking a cut, I guess we have to distinguish between the owners of the true owners of the business and the managers.
Let's say. And that's a better word choice, not the owner, but the top level in terms of the pyramid. Of those,
yeah, certainly at the restaurant level, if we're talking about McDonald's, the managers are not earning tremendous salaries. I think it's a pretty competitive market, and if you tried to pay them less, you wouldn't attract them.
No, I'm thinking about the CEO, not the owners who own the stocks, and not the guy who's running the individual McDonald's, but the CEO.
Yeah, my guess is. And I don't know what the CEO of McDonald's earns, but, this is a hotly debated topic within economics as to whether, CEO pay is in some sense excessive. But whether it's excessive or not, it's still even though these guys and ladies earn a lot of money, it's a pretty small fraction of the total revenue or costs of a place like McDonald's. I did a calculation once of suppose we took the salaries of the Fortune 500 top executives of the top 500 companies in the country. It's a lot of money. These guys earn a lot of money, but there are only 500 of them. If we took all those salaries and redistributed them evenly to every person in the United States, it would be a relatively small amount of money. I can't remember now exactly what it was, but it's a small amount of money. So even though they seem like they're earning outrageous amounts, it's not a big element of total costs.
All right, just a few minutes left, 11:55 here in the wake-up call. Scott, you had a follow-up question?
Yeah, two real brief ones. Number one, the numbers I saw on the fast food industry were a little different than 3-3-3 or third, third, third. So I thought there was a little more room.
Well, and
in
that's
the
probably true. Yeah. That was sort of my initial grade 101 class into how you, you know, things to do with the books.
Sure. But actually, my sort of question, and this is a, I think, a wonderfully fascinating topic you all have opened up, is, I mean, would you be interested in applying the concept of usury? We certainly have other parts of our society and other parts of economics where we apply the sort of ethical concept of it's unethical to charge or do this or charge more for things. And one argument might be to apply it the reverse. It's unethical to hire people for a full-time position that will not allow them to live a reasonable wage. And I realize there are unintended consequences to any economic decision, but that's certainly, I think, at the heart of the issue of the minimum wage. It's an ethical issue, and your point would be it has unintended economic consequences.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, it has consequences that we have to be aware of, and I guess my other point would be back to the statistic I mentioned earlier in the show, that it is not the case that most or even a substantial number of minimum wage workers are the heads of households at low income. So there are cases, and I'm sure there are important cases, but they're relatively small number as a fraction of all minimum wage workers are trying to support a household solely on the earnings of that minimum wage job. I'll point out, just so we can get our restaurant industry cred, one of my first jobs as a teenager was as a busboy in a now, I think, defunct, but at the time it was the biggest thing going, Howard Johnson's restaurant chain, and I still remember exactly what I earned. I earned $1.10 an hour as a busboy, and I remember getting my paycheck and being outraged that they were taking all the stuff out of it, so like FICA and other things. But so I've been there, at least in a minor way, earning the minimum wage in a restaurant job.
So just like a minute and a half left. So. And this certainly should have more time. Seattle, Washington has voted to increase their minimum wage to $15 an hour. And those in Tacoma, Washington, right next door, are having a problem with that. What do you foresee in the future?
Well, you know, there has been this wave of local, citywide minimums. Sometimes they go under the label of living wage ordinances, and often they only apply to certain groups of workers. Typically a group that a living wage ordinance would apply to would be wages of contractors who have contracts with the city. But there are a number of places around the country, often in politically liberal areas of the country, that have instituted these living wages. There have been studies of what the effect of this is. Again, often the groups that are pushing most for them are the unionized public employees, because from their point of view, contractors are low-priced competition, and they'd like to shut it down.
I wish we had more time to get to all of this. I still have half a page of questions to go, but that's what happens. Only an hour on the wake-up call. Professor Johnson, thank you so much for being here today.
Great to be here, Rick.
We will post the recording of this at WNRN.org as well as at SeavillePodcast.org. See everybody next week.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.